The viewpoints expressed on Liberty Works Radio Network are not necessarily those of the network, its affiliates, or sponsors. This is Liberty Works Radio Network. Now live from coast to coast and around the globe. More real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. It's Saturday, September 12th, 2009, and I'm very happy to be with you today. A special good morning to my friends in Florida listening on the Eagle 104.3 FM, and good morning to my friends listening on the web at lwrn.net. Given the many blessings God has bestowed on our country, I dedicate every show to our Father in heaven. So we'll start the show by praying as Jesus instructed us in Matthew chapter 6. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Well, our country is in deep, deep trouble, as I would imagine many of my listeners are well aware. I urge everyone to fervently pray for God's blessings on our country. Let's redouble our efforts to obey His commandments, especially refraining from taking the Lord's name in vain. I'm coming to you live, courtesy of Liberty Works Radio Network. I love that name, Liberty Works. Of course it does. We really need your help to keep Liberty Works Radio on the air, so hope you'll go to lwrn.net. That's the acronym for Liberty Works Radio Network, lwrn.net, and click on the Join Donate button. I always encourage my listeners to have a pen and paper handy so you can copy down important information. We always try to provide important information to you. For those who are new to the show, I'm a former IRS Criminal Investigation Division Special Agent. I no longer work for the IRS because during the last 2 years of my service there, I investigated claims and research others had made about the legality of IRS administration and enforcement of the federal income tax system. And I concluded that the claims they made about the federal income tax system, namely that the tax laws as passed by U.S. Congress did not require most Americans to file federal income tax returns and pay federal income tax, were actually true. Can't help it, but after 2 years of research, that's the conclusion I came to. Coming to this conclusion caused my IRS career to end rather abruptly, as you might imagine, in 1999, and I've been speaking out about my experiences and conclusions regarding the federal income tax and other liberty-related matters ever since. I'm featured in a movie called America: Freedom to Fascism, which I highly recommend you watch as soon as possible. You can type in the words America: Freedom to Fascism in a search engine and watch the movie for free, or you can go to freedomtofascism.com. And for those who haven't spelled fascism in a while, it's F-A-S-C-I-S-M. Well, my guest this morning
is attorney Larry Beecroft. And Larry's been on the show before. He's always very kind to just come on without a whole lot of notice. And Larry's going to be here. We're going to talk about the money system. And second hour, we're going to try to get into vaccines and your rights and maybe what the government's up to as far as vaccines. Larry, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Joe. How you doing?
Doing excellent. I really appreciate you coming on. As I said, we're going to talk about the money issue for most of the first hour and hopefully vaccines in the second hour. We're hoping to have a guest come on briefly at the end of the first hour, a gentleman named Gary Franchi. He's produced a movie called Camp FEMA, and that's F-E-M-A. And I know there's a lot of controversy about FEMA camps and whether or not they actually exist. So we're hoping to have him on the show. But in the meantime, Larry, got about 10 minutes until the break, but can we talk about money today? And maybe if you want to talk first about the current situation and maybe how we got here.
Joe, there is a company by the name of Goldman Sachs, a big securities firm in New York City. Of course, they have offices everywhere. The friends of paper money have always wanted to control you know, the financial transactions of the federal government. And, of course, Goldman Sachs is one of those friends of paper money, I like to call them. And, you know, we had Robert Rubin during the Clinton administration. He was straight out of Goldman Sachs, you know, our last Secretary of the Treasury. You know, that led us through this crisis of last fall. You know, he was straight up, Hank Paulson was straight out of Goldman Sachs. You know, we heard here earlier this year, well, a couple of months ago, it seems like, there was a report in the paper that Goldman Sachs, who was the recipient of about $10 billion in TARP money, Goldman Sachs made a quarterly profit of probably maybe March, April to, you know, sometime midsummer. They made $20 billion during that quarter. So the friends of paper money, you know, that's just one example of what happens on Wall Street. That's one example of what happens, you know, with the banking industry. You know, they use our current monetary system, and they love it. And the primary reason is it offers to them tremendous economic benefits. But, you know, this system that we have, you know, this flexible, expandable, contractible paper credit monetary system that we have is really detrimental to the interests of the American people. And, you know, I think we can see it right now. Over the last year and a half and 2 years, you know, I have a daily routine. You have a daily routine. You know, when I get up in the morning, the first thing I do is, you know, run to the stores. I buy breakfast for my wife and take it back home to her. I drop at the quick stop and get me a cup of coffee or something to drink with ice in it. You know, just your little old, during the course of the day, you can go into the grocery store or you can go any other place for your normal purchases. And we see, as a real, practical, everyday experience, that what we're paying for customary purchases increase. You know, for example, you know, I don't know what you do for lunch, but sometimes I go out and get a hamburger. You know, I can remember 10, 15, 20 years ago, you know, you could get a real good hamburger for, you know, $1.50. You know, now it's getting to be where you can only get a good hamburger for $5. And people that are on fixed incomes, like retirees, people that are just a mere employees or working for a company and they just get a salary, and economic times are hard, so you have to stay with what you make at the company. These people, in their everyday purchases, they're finding that they can purchase less and less and less with what they make. So here we have a system, you know, that's creating inflation. You can see from this just a simple little examples that I've provided to you right now. You know, the rate of inflation is increasing. The cost of buying goods, gasoline, food, you know, all of your everyday normal expenses, they keep increasing. And that means there's less real assets that is possessed by the average household.
Sounds like theft.
Yes, but, you know, the people that are making the big bucks, you know, everything's hunky-dory on Wall Street. And, you know, institutions and companies like Goldman Sachs, you know, they're the prime beneficiaries of the monetary system that we have, and the chief victims of this monetary system are the American people. And that's the reason why the money issue is so incredibly important for everyone. You know, John Adams was our second president. And he had lived during that period of time in which, you know, we were breaking away from Mother England. We were engaged in the Revolutionary War. The Revolutionary War was financed basically on a flood of paper money. And so they had rampant inflation during the Revolutionary War. You know, it got to be where, you know, just their small expenses, you know, they suffered from rampant inflation just like we're getting ready to suffer from it. But John Adams, who experienced those troubling times, he saw what happened with paper money. He saw what happened when we brought about constitutional changes by adoption of the U.S. Constitution. And then, of course, he became president of the United States. Back during that time frame, he lived and experienced, you know, a detrimental monetary system and then a beneficial monetary system. And he pointed out this. Ridiculous redeeming truth. You know, this is a statement that John Adams made. He said, of all the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America, they arise not from defects in our Constitution, not from want of honor or virtue, so much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. And that is true. You know, if you take a look across America, too many people are, you know, they're uneducated. They're ignorant about how our monetary system operates. And, of course, the system likes for them to be ignorant, because then people, if they're ignorant, you know, they're not going to oppose something that's detrimental to them.
So it's
and that's the reason why this topic, the true nature of coin, credit, and circulation, is so critically important.
So that's as if the thing that's the most important to people is the thing that generally they least understand, and of course that's what benefits the money masters, and you know, because they can keep on screwing people basically, and the people don't understand how they're being screwed.
So true, so true. So, you want to get into a little history of the monetary system in this country?
Well, as they say, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it, so I think that would be a good idea.
Let's talk a little bit, but I know we got a commercial break coming up here in about 2 minutes, but let's kind of give a little bit of an introduction. You know, when this country was founded, we had a silver coin that was in common circulation. It was called the Spanish Mill Silver Dollar, or pieces of eight. That's what the Spanish people called it. And, you know, since the Spanish had come over here to the New World, and, you know, their conquest, what they were looking for was gold and silver, you know, they did find a lot of silver mines. And so, you know, at the time of the founding of this country, when people were coming over here and landing on our shores, all the way up through the time of the Revolution, you know, the Spanish Mill silver dollar was the chief coin that floated commerce around the world, and so naturally we used it. And since we used it, that expression, we had a name for this common coin that was in circulation, the dollar. That's what we adopted as our monetary system. But by the time of the Revolution, you know, we had gold and silver coin in circulation. We were using primarily the Spanish Mill silver dollar. But, you know, that wasn't enough. That wasn't sufficient. You know, the money that was in circulation then wasn't sufficient to finance the Revolutionary War. So the state legislatures came out and they started emitting paper money to finance the war. The Continental Congress came out with paper money to finance this war. The war. True, it was beneficial, but it was still nonetheless a detrimental consequence, because the people, you know, you go back and take a look at the historical works of that time, and the American people were being, because there was so much paper money floating around, they were suffering from rampant inflation. And whenever you have rampant inflation, you know, what you're really doing is you're transferring wealth from the populace to whoever's issuing the paper money. And that's the way the Revolutionary War was financed.
So it sounds like, I mean, that must be one of the reasons why those who love war or making money off of war love central banks.
So true. You know, in fact, I think we would increase peace across the entire world if we got rid of our banking system. You know, governments, you know, they can sit there. They don't need to tax the people when they can go out and just issue a bunch of paper money. And by issuing paper money and making it legal tender, hey, they have all the resources of the entire economy. They can take it. And so gradually the governments that use paper money obtain, as a practical matter, greater and greater slices of the economic pie of any given society. And when they can do that, they can go out and finance all sorts of wars that, you know, the people themselves don't necessarily care for.
So the founders they experienced it firsthand, and so what they do about it?
Well, one of the reasons we had the Articles of Confederation that was in effect right after about 1783 through 1787 was really after the end of the war. We had a Congress that had been established by the Articles of Confederation. But you know, there was there was specific powers that the states had given to the Congress under the Articles of Confederation, and in order to amend the Articles of Confederation, it took 100% agreement for all the states.
Larry,
you know,
we got the break. The break's coming.
We're ready for a break.
Yeah, sorry. You're listening to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. Our guest is attorney Larry Beecraft, teaching us about money, both the past and currently. And we're happy Larry could join us. We'll be right back.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The entire world watched. They watched each step down the rungs of that small ladder, one after another, and waited with great anticipation for that last step.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
At that moment, humanity saw the impossible become the possible, and today the sky is not the limit. Achievement. Pass it on.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Liberty Works Radio Network.
It's the truth that no one else will say on the radio.
The philosophy of Barack Obama is predicated on one simple notion, and that's that it's okay to take from one person to give to another.
It's okay to take from one person to give to another.
He's the evil conservative saying what America's thinking.
Barney Frank, Tim Geithner, Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid. I want to know who's controlling these Muppets. Who's controlling these Muppets?
Truth to power.
It's the truth that no one else will say on the radio.
Only one man can do it. The evil conservative.
Listen, it'd be really easy to get rid of all the questions. Just show us the birth certificate.
He's the evil conservative.
Listen, sometimes somebody just has to say, it's an ugly baby.
Get it right.
Yes, the evil truth.
The evil conservative saying what America's thinking.
Weeknights at 10 on Liberty Works Radio Network, on Blog Talk Radio, and on the Eagle 104.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Shut up is the central rationale behind the leftist program. We've heard it expanded upon recently by Democrat bigwigs who want to bring back some version of the misnamed fairness doctrine to try to knock guys off the air. But even if the left can't turn shut up into law, they've worked hard over the years to make it the custom of the country. It's the essence of politically correct phraseology and university speech codes. Say it our way or shut up. It's inherent in the media's demonization of conservative commentators, the way they try to turn names like Limbaugh and Ann Coulter into bywords for intolerance so they'll just shut up. And why were there more than half a dozen movies attacking the war on terror and not one in support of it? Oh, wait, I know. Shut up. The left here has been making the shut-up argument at least since the 70s, when it became clear that all their other arguments had failed. Since it was the only argument remaining to them, they had to invent different ways to say it. If you pointed out that their weakness allowed the murderous tyranny of communism to expand, for instance, well, you were a McCarthyite. Shut up. If you proved that their leniency toward criminals turned our cities into cesspools, you were a fascist. Shut up. When you pointed out that their welfare policies destroyed black families and created a social disaster of vast proportions, you were a racist, a sexist, uncivil, worse than Hitler. All just different ways of saying, shut up. All around the world, as leftism has failed everywhere, shut-uppery has been called to its defense. The full-blown leftists, the communists, say shut up with prisons and guns. But the Western leftists, laboring under traditions of freedom, are suffering. In Europe, they've had more than 50 years of the sort of soft socialism the Democrats are now bringing here. Their anti-individualist, anti-religious, and anti-patriotic policies have so sapped the energies of the European nations that the continent's once great cultures are now flaccid and passive, fit for nothing but to be conquered in slow motion by the violent, intolerant Islamist invader within. But when people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Geert Wilders or Oriana Fallaci have the temerity to decry the left's empowerment of Islamist hatefulness, they're the ones brought up on charges of being hateful. Not because they're speaking falsely, mind you, but because, shut up. So now, the left is in charge of America. Shut up is on the march. Watch for that fairness doctrine. Beware of net neutrality. Pay attention to the ways the liberal mainstream news media distort, mock, insult, and exclude the conservative opposition. Listen to the people they don't want you to listen to. Whatever you do, don't shut up. Don't shut up. Don't shut up.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Now live from coast to coast and around the globe, more real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen.
Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. By the way, my website is freedomabovefortune.com, and you can join my mailing list there from that website. Our guest is attorney Larry Beecraft, and I cut Larry off when he was talking about the Revolutionary War period and the monetary system, which we're discussing. So, Larry, without further ado, please continue.
Well, Joe, you know, the monetary system was in a state of flux, if you want to call it that, during the Revolutionary War period. And, you know, you had, of course, gold and silver coins circulating, but, you know, what was primarily being used as a medium of exchange, the money of this country, was the Continental Note. And everybody remembers the old expression, it's not worth the Continental. And that's hung around with us for many, many years. And the reason is because it had a real economic and social impact upon the American people. You know, the people that were issuing that money got the wealth and resources to finance the Revolutionary War. Of course, that was beneficial, but you know, that wealth was just taken straight out of the people. So, too many people were cognizant of the harm caused by paper money. So, when they had the Continental Convention, the Constitutional Convention that assembled in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia, one of the things that they wanted to do was to bring about monetary reform. So a decision was made. They needed paper money to be banished. And when you sit down and you read the notes of the Constitutional Convention, you know, there are express statements. You know, the men that assembled there and drafted the Constitution said, we want to stamp out paper money. And so they did it. And one of the reasons why scholars say this, you know, the convention banished paper money because they said no state shall make anything other than gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, and they put that in Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution. So they banished paper money by that constitutional provision. Then the idea was, well, we need to have a central source to provide, you know, the money of this country, which was to be gold and silver coin. So they delegated to Congress the power under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 of the United States Constitution. They said Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. So what the scheme that was set up by the Constitutional Convention was, no state can make anything, you know, only the states had the power to declare a legal tender. And it said no state can make anything but gold and silver coin as tender and payment of debts. And then they delegated the coining power to Congress. So as a result of that, constitutional scheme being established, in 1792, Congress comes along and they come out with the first Coinage Act. And what they did to determine what a dollar is they took about 1,000 Spanish mill silver dollars, melted them down, threw off the impurities in the coinage, and from that mass, you know, they determined how many grains of pure silver was in it, and then they divided all those grains, the total number of grains, by 1,000, the number of coins that they put in, and so they came up with an average weight of a silver coin that was in common circulation at that time. And they said, this is what our dollar is, 372.25, 371.25 grains of pure silver. And since the Constitution said and used the word dollar, the 1792 Coinage Act came along and defined, as a matter of fact, what a dollar is. And they concluded that it was a weight of pure silver. And that silver dollar that was established by the Coinage Act of 1792 is what the, you know, all the way up through the 20s and the 30s, what was being minted by the pursuant to the various laws of Congress. And so if you go to a coin store today and say, hey, I want to get a silver dollar, you know, like a Morgan that was minted all the way up until the 1920, and then after World War One, it was the peace dollar. You can go out and you can get these silver dollars, and there's absolutely no difference between them and the Spanish mill silver dollar that was in circulation back in the 1700s here in this country. And so that is what a dollar is. But in contrast to that type of a monetary system, well, let me stop right there. Once we brought about monetary sanity, if you will, we had established a good scheme for a monetary system in this country as a result of the adoption of the United States Constitution. You know, everybody, George Washington, John Adams, you know, all of our founding fathers sat there and, you know, having lived through that period of time in which the early states, the young states, had been flooded by paper money. And then you have a constitutional convention, and we bring about monetary sanity by the constitutional provisions, and then they start providing the nation with gold and silver coin. Then those people actually experienced economic growth. I mean, there was a world of difference between a paper money system and a gold and silver system, and they saw it, and they said it was beneficial. Now, here's where the problem comes up. You know, in the 1600s, banking got it started. And you had the Bank of Amsterdam, which was basically a warehouse bank, and merchants would use the Bank of Amsterdam to deposit their gold and silver coin, and the bank would give them receipts for the money. Any particular customer of the Bank of Amsterdam would get a receipt for the gold and silver coin that he deposited there. Experience showed that rather than people coming to the bank and getting their gold and silver coin, people were using as a medium of exchange these notes, these warehouse receipts issued by the Bank of Amsterdam. From that, you know, you have a system of banking that arose. You know, let me give you an example of how banking operated once it was determined that people would use the notes of a bank as a medium of exchange. Let's say that in London, England, in, you know, the 1700s, five elitists, if you want to call it that, get together and they said, hey, we want to create a bank. And so they pooled together 100,000 pounds of silver coin. Well, then they would get into the banking business, and they would learn over a period of time that reserve that they had of gold and silver coin, and here in our hypothetical example, we're saying 100,000 pounds, you know, pounds being the British monetary unit, they could have 200,000, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 in outstanding notes. And this is called fractional reserve banking. And fractional reserve banking is having greater liabilities outstanding on the part of the bank than the bank has. As in the way of reserves. Well, you know, right after, at the same time period of the Revolutionary War, and at the time that we were, you know, coming out with the United States Constitution, you know, banking was beginning to raise its head here in the United States. One of the first banks was in Philadelphia, and you know, it operated as a fractional reserve bank, just like I've just described. Then in 1792, you know, there were the forces came together to persuade Congress and people like Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton was, a monarchist. You know, he was an elitist. But, you know, they came out with the, what we call the first Bank of the United States, and it had a life of about 20 years. And it finally was closed in 1812. But it was nothing more than another fractional reserve bank. And one of the reasons why it was closed is because people saw the detrimental consequence of it. Of course, at the same time, we have the War of 1812, and by 1816, we have the second Bank of the United States that gets created. And, of course, by the time you get up to the 1830s, you have Andrew Jackson, the hero of New Orleans. He becomes elected, he's elected President of the United States. Incidentally, his home was the Hermitage in Nashville, Tennessee, and I used to live on Hermitage here in Huntsville, and my office is presently on Andrew Jackson Way here in Huntsville. So, you know, Andy Jackson is one of my heroes. But, you know, Andy Jackson saw in his lifespan the detrimental consequences of fractional reserve banking. And so when he came into office in 1832, you know, here you had a man by the name of Nicholas Biddle that was operating the second bank of the United States. And, you know, a war was started. Andrew Jackson called the bankers a den of vipers. And he swore to stamp them out. And so a great big battle was created by Andy Jackson and Nicholas Biddle, the president of the second Bank of the United States. And that lasted for a couple of years. And, of course, Nicholas Biddle, wanting to continue his paper money scheme, you know, pulled out all the stops, man. He paid congressmen with the banknotes of the Bank of the United States, the second Bank of the United States. But, you know, in the end, after this big, huge battle, political battle was fought, Congress finally decided, nope, we're not going to have the second Bank of the United States, and its charter was not renewed. Well, Nicholas Biddle took this battle and his loss very personally, and he threatened to do what a lot of banks have done when they have a dominant economic position in any given society. You know, a fractional reserve bank can sit there and expand, you know, the outstanding banknotes, and it can contract the outstanding banknotes. And during expansion, you know, let's say in our little example I used a minute ago, the bankers in England that had 100,000 pounds in reserves, and let's say that they had $500,000 in outstanding notes. Well, as they expand the issuance of their notes, you know, there's some economic good times. But then, when that cabal of bankers makes a decision in a community that you're going to contract the outstanding notes, then you're going to have a real serious economic problem. And, you know, of course, the people that operate these banks, when they contract their outstanding notes, you know, they call in their loans. And so if you have somebody that's a borrower of the bank that's got a real pretty good business going on, he's going to end up being hurt by all this. And this allows the bankers, you know, to selectively target some of their customers to take over their assets. And that has been one of the chief, you know, through the 1800s and the late 1800s, the early 1900s, that's the way a lot of these banks operated. You know, they would exist, they would operate in a certain community, they would expand and contract their outstanding notes, and as a consequence, you know, you had wealth that just kind of flowed into the bankers and the operators of these fractional reserve banks. And that's the reason why it's so detrimental to. There's a tremendous benefit for those that operate this system, but any society that allows you know, this type of routine to go on, you know, to provide the economic life of that community, will find that, you know, a bank, a fractional reserve bank, will become a economically dominant, if you will.
So it sounds like these banks, I mean, for thousands and thousands of years, they have a well-oiled machine. They know exactly how to get their fingers into an economy,
yeah,
and basically take over everyone's property, diminish the value of their property, and just, again, cheat them and ultimately screw them.
That's the whole purpose of fractional reserve banking, is to It's an organized system for, a fractional reserve bank exists in kind of an agricultural community like our country was in the, 1800s and the early 1900s. You know, they would sit there and they would provide the medium of exchange for that area, their state or wherever they were located. They would provide the economy. But they could expand and contract the economy of their geographical area where they operated, and it was extremely beneficial for those bankers. But that's one of the reasons that the Andy Jackson saw how these guys operated, and that's the reason why he said, "You're a den of vipers, and I'm going to destroy the Second Bank of the United States," which he did. And then, as a consequence of all this, you'll find that. From the late 1830s all the way up through the time of the Civil War, this country was booming economically. And the reason for that is because, at the higher levels, at the higher political and economic levels, like at the federal level, we had Andy Jackson there.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The entire world watched. They watched each step down the rungs of that small ladder, one after another, and waited with great anticipation for that last step.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
At that moment, humanity saw the impossible become the possible, and today the sky is not the limit. Achievement. Pass it on.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Is Liberty Works Radio Network enlightening you to the real problems we face in our constitutional republic? Has it helped you to better understand what has to be done to save America from becoming a third world nation? If so, do your part in spreading this voice of truth and enlightenment to your fellow Americans. Join the Liberty Works Radio Network Fellowship. Go to www.libertyworksradionetwork.com for details.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Hey, everybody. Gather around. I'm here to give you anything you like. You want free college, energy, mortgages, whatever you like. You have come to the right place. Why? I'll tell you why. Who can take your money?
Who can take your money?
With a twinkle in their eye.
A twinkle in their eye.
Take it all away and give it to some other guy. The government.
The government.
The government can.
The government can.
And who can tax the sunrise?
Who can tax the sunrise?
Who can tax the trees?
Let
you run a business and collect up all the fees. The government.
The government.
Oh, the government can.
The government can.
And the government can, cause they mix it up with lies and make it all taste good.
Make it all taste good.
The government takes everything we make to pay for all of their solutions. Healthcare, climate change, pollution. Throw away the Constitution. And who can give a bailout?
Who can give a bailout?
Tell us to behave.
Tell us to behave.
And make the founding fathers roll over in the grave. The government.
The government.
Oh, the government can.
The government can.
And the government can, cause they mix it up with lies and make it all taste good.
Government takes everything we
have to eat our dishes.
Delicious.
Oh, who can be a failure?
In so many ways.
Instead of getting fired, hey, we'll give ourselves a raise. The government.
Now live from coast to coast and around the globe, more real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. You can read more about me and my efforts at freedomabovefortune.com. That's freedomabovefortune.com. As planned, and I'm very happy to
welcome to the show a gentleman named Gary Franchi. Gary, and he'll tell me the name of his other producer, who I know has done a number of films himself, but they are releasing September 18th a movie called Camp FEMA. And I know there's been quite a bit of controversy, you know, the people that watch Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity and that kind of thing versus people who are looking at facts and evidence that indicate that there are FEMA camps, there are efforts underway by our government to put us into camps, much like the Japanese were put into camps in World War II. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Gary Franchi to you all and just let Gary talk about why he made the movie, what's in the movie, and why you should see the movie. Gary?
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, the discussion of FEMA, most people never get to the point of their multifaceted objectives, and you know, most people think of FEMA in the capacity that it's disaster recovery. That's the most common description you see it on the news, and of course on the Florida area there with so many hurricanes, people, you know, oh, FEMA is going to come and drop off water bottles and, you know, set up triage and all these types of things. But they don't realize that FEMA has other objectives, and that is setting up national emergency centers or places to detain Americans in the event of national declared emergencies. And that's why we set out to make this film, because we wanted to get down to the real facts. There's a lot of disinformation on the internet about FEMA's third objective, which is you know, quelling national dissent. And the film goes into great detail discussing legislation such as H.R. 645, which sets up national emergency centers nationwide, six FEMA regions. It discusses the history of FEMA and some of their failed national emergency efforts in different hurricane relief situations. But we also looked at the history of our own government in times of great crisis, turning on its own people out of paranoia. And you mentioned the Japanese internment camps, and that's a perfect example. In fact, I had an opportunity during the filming to sit down with a gentleman named Sam Ozaki, a survivor of the camps, And, you know, unfortunately only about, you know, maybe 3 or 4 minutes of his experience made it into the film. But I sat down with him for an hour and I talked to him. And I learned, you know, that he was an American citizen at the time, born in the United States, and he and his family were taken. They actually had to surrender themselves. They could only carry what they had in their two hands. They had to report to these centers. Over 120,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up, and it's a tragic story. You know, some 45 years later or so, Reagan came out and apologized, and they paid reparations to the Japanese Americans, but then they did it again on 9/11. Here we are, just after the 8th anniversary, they did it again to the Arab American community. And now, what we've discovered is, see, there's a template for the United States government. There's a template for their behavior that we've had, a pattern that we've discovered. And it's an old pattern. I mean, it's a pattern that Hitler used when he wanted to round up the Jews. And that pattern is to demonize a section of the population, a segment of the population, and then eventually give cause to round them up. And what we discovered now is a new demonization is taking place in America, and it's the demonization of those who love the Constitution. It's the demonization of people who might support a Ron Paul or a third party candidate like Bob Barr or Chuck Baldwin. You know, these things are happening. There's documentation that is being put up by the Department of Homeland Security, which was originally intended, you know, to secure the homeland from foreign terrorists. Well, it seems as though they've gotten a little bored looking outside the borders, and well, now they're looking inside the borders. And it's not, they're not looking for terrorists running terror cells and, you know, planting explosives in shoes. They're looking at Americans who have strong beliefs in the Constitution, who believe in the Second Amendment. The list goes on and on, and it's very sad. So we've analyzed the patterns, and we've come to the conclusion, based on legislation, that we are very close, very, very close, to national roundups of constitution-loving Americans. It's just going to take a couple trigger mechanisms. There could be another false flag event, another type of a 9/11 blamed on a domestic front. It could be a swine flu pandemic where everyone's forced to report to inoculation centers, get vaccinated. If you don't get vaccinated, then you're going to go ahead and they're going to put you in a camp. They're going to make you rat on your neighbor. You know, hey, did your neighbor get vaccinated? Go and check on them. If they didn't, give us a call over here at Homeland Security. You know, I mean, these are very real and very scary realities. And what the film does is it takes a look at a history of FEMA, a history of states that turn on their people, and applies it to what we know today. And I want people to check it out. It is coming out September 18th. There's a bunch of movie trailers we put up at campfema.com. So everyone out there, write that down, campfema.com, and take a look for yourself.
Gary, does the...
You'll be shocked.
I know part of the controversy seems to be that you know, there's film out there been taken of places that people claimed were FEMA camps. Are there actually camps, whether they be, you know, old military properties or some kind of new construction? Do you actually see evidence of existing camps, or is this all legislation and a framework that's being put into place?
A lot of it's legislation and framework. We do have photographs of camps in the film, scattered throughout the country. Primarily, one thing that we learned in the investigation was that anything can be a FEMA camp. Any freestanding structure, airplane hangar, high school gym, or even you know, football stadium. Any of these things can be used and retrofitted to serve the purposes of detention centers. We discovered this, and it was interesting because during the Ozaki interview, I asked him. I said, "Well, where did you have to report to?" And he said that we actually reported to the horse tracks, to the racetracks, and the fairgrounds. And these locations, because the camps were not even built. So, in some cases, the camps are not built. They're contracts that are basically in waiting to be fulfilled. A camp can be put up within 24 hours. They can take an open field. They can drop these very specific camp. I forget what they're called. They can set up a base in 24 hours.
Well, yeah, I think I've seen a video of, I don't know if it's in your film, but I mean, how quickly camps can be set up, either, you know, made out of some kind of canvas or rubber, plastic, or even concrete bunkers that are just placed together like a jigsaw puzzle, and they've just got it, a well-oiled machine, so it can be done literally in a few days or a week or a month. So like you say, when the framework is being put in place and you have evidence of that, they may be holding off on, you know, assembling a bunch of camps because that might get attention. But if they spread out all the materials all over the country, like for example the coffins, do you have anything about the coffins in your film?
You know, that was one thing we discussed, William Lewis and I, about putting into the film, and we strayed away from that immediately because we only want to put stuff in there that we could prove, and there were still some elements of doubt related to that. The investigation is not done. You know, William and I have already discussed taking the investigation further and producing a companion film, a sequel, if you would. I mean, first of all, we just didn't have the budget to go out and physically put our boots on the ground and investigate specific locations. So we weren't able to go and do that, but we did have lots of different photographs that we discovered, as well as the framework. But the other thing, though, that should be brought up is that the BRAC, the base realignment program that took place during the Clinton administration, a lot of those bases were converted to public use. In fact, in my own town here, and we may even do a small feature on that in the next film, is they turned the Navy base here into a big shopping mall and residential area. And about 30 minutes north of here, they turned an old Army base into, again, another large, you know, high-class residential neighborhood. So we know that they've converted these bases to public use, but some are still mothballed bases that can be converted at a moment's notice. That can, you know, they're just sitting there dormant, And we really need to get into that and investigate some of those locations and find out. But there's so many bases that were closed. The amount of research that's required is just overwhelming.
Gary, we got only about 30 seconds, so why don't you quickly just give the listeners your website again and how they can get a hold of the movie?
Yeah, go on over to campfema.com. Check out the trailers over there. You know, it's not easy information to absorb, but we put the information together. It's information that you need to know as an American because our freedom and our liberty depends on it. CampFEMA.com.
Fantastic. Well, Gary, thanks for joining us for this brief segment here. We'll have you back on the show another time, and best of luck with the unveiling of the movie.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
All right. Have a good day. Take care. Bye. Listeners, we'll be right back.
Liberty Works Radio Network.
The American dream was nurtured in the beginning by Thomas Jefferson, one of the greatest defenders of liberty in our history. It was Jefferson's words in the Declaration of Independence that proclaimed God's plan for government to be ordained. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. He clearly understood that history has proven government to be the tool of the greedy and the power hungry, that mankind, seeking safety, is forever falling into the trap of total reliance on government. He warned, "It is error alone that needs the support of government. Truth can stand by itself."
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting. Liberty Works Radio Network, enlightening you to the real problems we face in our constitutional republic, helping you to better understand what has to be done to save America from becoming a third world nation. Please do your part in spreading this voice of truth and enlightenment to your fellow Americans. Join the Liberty Works Radio Network Fellowship. Go to www.libertyworksradionetwork.com for details. Liberty Works Radio, truth in broadcasting.
I pledge allegiance to the Constitution of the American States United and to the Republic which it created, implementing God's governmental plan for man and asking His blessing for its observance, which will provide liberty and justice for all, for all, for all, for all.
Several months ago, I watched as Sarah Palin delivered an inspiring speech to the nation, and I was proud to be a conservative. Today's celebration reminds me of just how blessed I am to be an American. When I was given the opportunity to compete in the Tropicana Speech Contest, I knew that I would write about something dear to me, my freedom. My speech is entitled America's Freedom and is dedicated to my great-grandmother Lev, who recently passed away at the age of 95. What do you think about when I say the word freedom? Some think about America being a free country, and others just think about having rights and being free. You probably think this speech is about freedom, but no. It is about how Americans are slowly losing their freedoms. My parents have taught me to love my country, and I appreciate the blood that was shed for our freedom. From the beaches of Normandy to the sands of Iraq, Americans have paid a great price so we could live free. Sadly, many among us just don't seem to care about the sacrifice it took to build this great nation. It seems as though we're more interested in our own pleasures than preserving our independence and liberties. Truth is, there's many who want to change our way of life, who don't respect the great traditions of America. These are the same people who support the growing attack upon our private property in the name of environmental protection, or the recent talk of limiting free speech with the Fairness Doctrine. Now, there's a twist for you. How can it be fair if the people don't get to choose for themselves? Where is the freedom in that? There are those who continually attempt to shoot down our right to bear arms promised by the Second Amendment. On a personal level, we've seen independence, self-reliance, and individual responsibility replaced with complacency and apathy. Today, many of our schools don't teach the values and patriotic pride that my parents were taught just a few years ago. Yeah, a price may have been paid on the battlefield, but the war is far from over. If we don't act now, before it's too late, we won't have any freedoms left. And America will no longer be the America we know and love. John Adams said it best when he wrote, "A constitution of government, once changed from freedom, can never be restored. Liberty, once lost, is lost forever." I believe we have a patriotic responsibility to stand up to those who seek to destroy these constitutional freedoms. If you believe in the values and principles that make this nation great, and if you enjoy the freedoms we have as Americans, then join me. Join me in standing up to those who seek to destroy these freedoms. Join me in taking back this great nation and protecting our independence and liberties. Because you can make a difference. I can make a difference. And together, we will make a difference. Thank you, and God bless.
The viewpoints expressed on Liberty Works Radio Network are not necessarily those of the network, its affiliates, or sponsors. This is Liberty Works Radio Network. Now live from coast to coast and around the globe. More real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen.
Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. My website is freedomabovefortune.com. I invite you to join my email list. You can do that there at the website. Well, our guest for the last hour was attorney Larry Beecraft. He's continues to be with us, and we let Gary Franchi, co-producer, co-director of the Camp FEMA movie, come in for the last segment of last hour. Again, that website is campfema.com, campfema.com. Gary had said on the break, you know, after we left for the break, that he really, really tried to discern, you know, the truth, stay away from paranoia, the propaganda, fishtails that are out there, and just concentrate on the facts. So, and I've known Gary for quite a long time. He's fact-driven. So, you know, if you want a hard-hitting movie that you can actually learn the truth in this debate about FEMA camps and what our government might be planning for us, I'd recommend you at least see the trailer at campfema.com. Anyway, we're going to come back here with our guest, Larry Beecraft, attorney from Alabama, and Larry's going to finish off on the money issue, and we might dovetail a little bit into vaccines and your rights. We were supposed to be joined by Robert Broaddus. He's a congressional candidate, ran in the past, and is running again. He's attending the 9/12, quote-unquote, festivities in Washington, D.C. He was going to try to check in with a little update on what's going on there. Haven't heard from him yet, so we don't know if he's going to try to join us. But then we might as well just go right back to Larry. And Larry, if you could continue with the money discussion, the history.
My pleasure, Joe. I would like to tell people about where you can go to get some good information about the money issue. You can't cover a complex, detailed issue like this just in a radio program. I would direct people to just go over to one of the search engines. Don't use Google or something like that. You use some alternative. Google's a part of the problem. But do a web search, and I've got a lot of information on my website. And the best way to get to my website, because I got kind of a unique URL, just in a search engine, type in Beecraft Briefs. And Beecraft is spelled B-E-C-R-A-F-T, Beecraft. And Beecraft Briefs, and it'll carry it over to my website. And you've got such things over there as, you know, the articles by Edwin Vieira. Edwin Vieira is a man that I consider to be one of the most... he's brilliant. He's a intellectual, and he's one of the champions of the money issue, the hard money camp. And he's got a book out called Pieces of Eight, And he's got a lot of other speeches that he's given around the country, and I've got them posted over on my website. That's one thing that people ought to read, the materials by Edwin Vieira. But I've got a lot of other information on my website. One of the things that I think is real important for people that want to inquire and dig into this issue, the money issue, I think that this information is posted over on DV's website, and it's either on DV.com or DV.net. And DV is a lady, DV kid. She's from, you know, all over, really. She grew up in California, lived for a long time in California. They went to Colorado and then back to California. Now she's living in Texas, and she's a writer for News with Views. But she may have posted over her website this story about John Law. And I think the John Law situation is, anybody that's interested in studying the money issue, it's critically important that you read some information about John Law. And when you deal with the John Law story, you're having the whole operation of, you know, paper money, fractional reserve banking system, it's all telescoped into a short period of time in France. You know, back in the early 1700s, John Law came up with this, you know, way to rescue France from its economic doldrums, and he set up a bank, and things boomed for a while. He was operating the bank, but then it collapsed, as every paper money system does. You know, it cranks out worthless credit and paper. And in the wake of the destruction caused by John Law and his paper money scheme, you know, France was in a worse position. But if people would stop and read that story, the John Law story, about how France, you know, prospered for a while, but then was economically destroyed by a paper money system operated by John Law. Once you understand those, you know, segments of that story, then you can translate that into, you know, everyday life. You can see exactly what is going on in America. You can match the history of the United States and fractional reserve banking and paper money, and you can fit what we've experienced with the John Law experience. And of course, John Law's experience, that story shows that, hey, it fell apart at the very end and made matters worse, and that's exactly where we're headed, Joe. But it's real important for anybody that's interested in this issue to know the history behind, you know, the fractional reserve banking and paper money here in this country. We got real important events like Congress in 1863 came along and created the national banks. And those national banks, the people that chartered those banks, became extraordinarily wealthy, because that's exactly what a paper money system does. It makes the operators of a paper money system, you know, wealthy, and it destroys the wealth of the people that have to deal with paper money. And that's a big problem. The people that created and got the National Banking Act of 1863 passed through, they became the very same people that created, back in 1909, the monetary crisis here in this country, that was the impetus, the cause, if you will, of Congress coming along and in December of 1913 coming along and creating, quote, the big central bank for the United States, the Federal Reserve System, which was the result of a conspiracy of the people that were really behind the effort to create the Federal Reserve System. They went to Jekyll Island and devised this whole scheme and for how they were going to get the Federal Reserve System adopted in this country. Well, once we got the Federal Reserve System adopted in this country in 1913, you know, now we had a credit mechanism that was in place so they could finance World War One. And, of course, the Federal Reserve Banks greatly expanded the credit during the early years that they got started. They helped finance World War One, but then right after that, they contracted credit. You know, they had a meeting in May of 1920 and said, hey, we're going to deliver the contract credit, and they did it, and they destroyed agriculture here in this country. Then right after that, they turned around and created the Roaring Twenties. And, you know, then they, after they create the Roaring Twenties, they're going to create a collapse. And that's exactly what caused the Great Depression of the 30s. So, you know, we have, you know, if you look at the history of the operation of this paper money system we have in this country, that history tells you exactly how these, you know, this fractional reserve banking system operates. And it's detrimental to the American people. And that's the reason why, so, you know, we will not have economic prosperity in this country until we have a monetary system that is set up to foster economic growth for the vast majority of the American people. And that won't happen with a fractional reserve banking system. The only monetary system that's going to help the American people is what, you know, I call it a free man's monetary system. And my personal opinion is that has to be gold and silver coin, and primarily, you know, the dollar as embodied in the United States Constitution, which is, the dollar of our daddies, which is the silver dollar. And if we had a monetary system that was based on the precious metals, that would be beneficial for the American people. We wouldn't have a monetary system. It really is nothing. You know, we use claims against banks. What you have in your checking account is nothing more than a demand deposit. And we use demand deposits as a medium of exchange. Demand deposits don't exist. They're just legal claims against some financial institution, a bank. And we use that as our medium of exchange, and it can expand and contract at the will of the people that operate this. You know, that wouldn't happen if we had real money in existence and we used that as a medium of exchange. And if that was dispersed across the American population, we wouldn't have these economic problems. We have recessions and depressions. What are they really called? That's not an accident of the economy. What that really is, it's a banking crisis or a created banking crisis. It's the banking cycle. And the banking cycle is what recessions and depressions are.
And that's the nature of the system. They can't operate the system as they do and not have these booms and busts, right? Because they're constantly pushing on the gas, letting off on the gas.
Yeah.
Trying to manage it, but manage it really in a way they can just keep the scam going and the people won't notice, as you said at the beginning of the show about the price of bread, the price of milk. Those are the ways that we in the public actually notice what they're up to. Can you speak briefly, Larry, on the maybe the notion that some people might have that, he keeps talking about these gold and silver, as a medium of exchange, but, it's so much more convenient with my debit card, and I don't want to carry around all that stuff in my pocket. I mean, you can still have a system based on gold and silver, and yet still have the electronic age that we have. Isn't that correct?
Well, yeah, absolutely. But the way money comes into existence today is a bank just merely extends credit to a borrower. And we use that credit that is created by a bank as a medium of exchange. Now, here is let me give you a simple little example that shows the problem when you borrow money into circulation. Joe, imagine you're on an island, a small island. Five men are there. And, they've been shipwrecked. And they want to build an economy there. But they also want to play, games, too. So in one quiet moment, one day these guys are on this island, this deserted island, and said, hey, let's play some cards. Well, there are four card players, but they don't have any cards. Well, there's the fifth man on the island. He does happen to have a deck of cards. So he says, I will loan to you card players the cards that you need to play your game. So what he does is he doles out 13 cards to each card player, and he gets back a promissory note. Each card player, they only get 13 the cards dealt to them, but they get back a promissory note promising to pay the card owner 13 cards plus one in the way of interest. And so once all the cards are doled out, everybody's given the card owner these promissory notes, and they start playing. Well, here, let me tell you about what the economic or the mathematical flaw of this whole the system of borrowing cards into circulation is, what it creates. If you take a look at the total number of cards in circulation, there's only 52 cards. That's the total number in the deck. Well, how about the aggregate liabilities of all four card players is what? It's more than the 52. In fact, if you total up 13 cards plus one away of interest, that's 14 cards each card player owes to the card owner. The total number of debts, the aggregate liabilities of all the players is 56. So, Joe, how in the world can you discharge a debt having 52 cards? How can you discharge the liability for 56 cards? It's mathematically impossible.
That's right.
And yet that is the reason why, that's an apt description of the monetary system that we have today. You know, all of our The medium of exchange is borrowed into circulation, and that's the reason why debt will keep on increasing, 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 and increasing. Well, there's an alternative to, a system that's based on credit, where the credit is borrowed into circulation, and that is to use actual real wealth as a medium of exchange. And when that happens, we don't have the debt increasing. We don't have a debt-based monetary system. We have actual wealth being used as a medium of exchange and circulating among the people, and they're the ones that actually benefit by the operation of that type of a monetary system, instead of being victims of the operation of the monetary system.
And that's sadly what people don't seem to realize, is that, you know, this whole game, that this banking system that we have, is designed to benefit somebody, and it's not the American people, and that's why the constitutional limits that our founders put were so important. Anyway, we've got a break coming up. Our guest is attorney Larry Beecraft. We're talking about the history of money, and we'll be right back after the break. Thanks for joining us.
America. Born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Determination. Pass it on. Brooke Ellison is a surprising person.
When I was 11 years old, I was hit by a car and no one expected me to live.
She surprised people by living.
I've been paralyzed from the neck down and on a ventilator since that time.
And she surprised them by going to college.
Tomorrow, I will graduate from Harvard.
Determination. Pass it on.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Liberty Works Radio Network.
It's the truth that no one else will say on the radio.
The philosophy of Barack Obama is predicated on one simple notion, and that's that it's okay to take from one person to give to another.
It's okay to take from one person to give to another.
He's the evil conservative saying what America's thinking.
Barney Frank, Tim Geithner, Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid. I want to know who's controlling these Muppets. Who's controlling these Muppets?
Truth to power.
It's the truth that no one else will say on the radio.
Only one man can do it. The evil conservative.
Listen, it'd be really easy to get rid of all the questions. Just show us the birth certificate.
He's the evil conservative.
Listen, sometimes somebody just has to say, it's an ugly baby.
Get it right.
Yes, the evil truth.
The evil conservative saying what America's thinking.
Weeknights at 10 on Liberty Works Radio Network, on Blog Talk Radio, and on the Eagle 104.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network.
There's a reason education's because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. It's the big, wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're an irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they get by a system that threw them overboard. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
In 1987, some inner-city first graders were promised a college education. Now, this promise didn't come from a wealthy corporation. It came from Oral Lee Brown, who saved a large portion of her modest income every year for these children.
I told Ms. Brown, you can't do everything I said, no, but we need to do more.
And she did more by sending 19 kids to college, helping others. Pass it on.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Now live from coast to coast and around the globe, more real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host.
Our guest for these entire 2 hours has been attorney Larry Beecraft. We had Gary Franchi, the co-producer of the movie Camp FEMA. You can go to campfema.com for more information on that. But Larry's been sharing with us the history of the monetary system, and we were talking during the break that maybe we'd at least spend a few minutes on the relationship between the federal income tax and the monetary system. I'm sure Larry will explain that it wasn't a coincidence that in 1913 both the monetary system that we know today with some tweaking and the income tax system that we know today with some tweaking both came into being in 1913. The money system with the Federal Reserve Act and the income tax with the 16th Amendment, which was proclaimed to be ratified, but there's compelling evidence to indicate it was never ratified. Nevertheless, both these systems came upon us in 1913. Somehow the country was able to survive without them prior to 1913. So Larry, maybe you could give us a little historical context as to why both these things came into play in 1913.
Okay, well, before we get around to answering that question, Joe, I think we need to provide a little bit of a background. The United States Constitution, you know, the way it was framed when the framers met in Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention back in 1787, you know, the states were imposing taxes at that time that were primarily the direct taxes. But, you know, the decision of the Constitution was, well, we need to give the federal government a higher taxation. So they said, we're going to let the federal government operate primarily off of indirect taxes, which was the field the states weren't occupying. You know, they didn't have a whole lot of indirect taxes. So they said, oh, Uncle Sam's going to have the indirect taxes. And the rule for imposing those is that they've got to be uniform throughout the country. So, you know, primarily for customs and stuff like that, you know, that's the primary source of revenue that Uncle Sam was given as a result of the Constitutional Convention and the Constitution itself. In case there was an emergency, Congress was given the constitutional authority to impose direct taxes. But in order to ensure that, you know, Congress wouldn't do that very often, they made it very hard for Congress to impose the direct taxes. And the Constitution says that direct taxes must be must be apportioned among the several states. Apportionment's kind of real difficult. I'll give you an example of how apportionment would come about or how it would operate. Let's suppose that Congress wanted to build a battleship that cost $10 billion. Well, you know, each, and they wanted to raise raise the money for that battleship by means of a direct tax. Each state would pay a part of the cost for that battleship. They'd pay a part of the direct tax. And the amount of direct tax that each state would pay would be apportioned according to the percentage representation that state had in Congress. So, for example, if California has 10%, I'm just rounding things off. I don't really think California's got 12% of the population of this country. But let's presume 10%. Well, if Congress was going to raise $10 billion by means of a direct tax, California, since it has 10% of the representatives in Congress, it will pay 10% of a direct tax. And so that's what apportionment money is. Apportionment's real difficult for Congress to do. You know, it's not very easy. So that's the reason why Congress was looking primarily to the indirect taxes as a source of revenue for the federal government. Back in 1894, the Supreme Court decided the question of the constitutionality of the 1894 income tax. And the Supreme Court said, oh, well, you know, an income tax is a direct tax. And since that particular 1894 Act wasn't apportioned, the Supreme Court found it to be unconstitutional. That is what necessitated the 16th Amendment. The 16th Amendment was proposed in 1909, and in February 1913, it was allegedly ratified. And the cases say today, you know, the power of the federal government to impose the income tax in light of the Constitution and the construction of the Constitution, the meaning of the Constitution that the Supreme Court has provided in reference to this matter through its decisions. The 16th Amendment allegedly allows this direct tax, known as the income tax, to be imposed without apportionment. And so once we had the amendment in place by February 1913, in October 1913, Congress passed the first income tax under the 16th Amendment. Well, immediately, just like in 1894 when Congress passed the 1894 Act, that act was challenged in a case called Pollock against Farmers Loan and Trust. Similarly, when Congress comes along and opposes the Act of 1913, the Income Tax Act of 1913, pursuant to the 16th Amendment, that act was immediately challenged. And that went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided in 1916 a case called Brookshaver versus Union Pacific Railroad. And, of course, there the Supreme Court, you know, provides an explanation for how the 16th Amendment operates. But, you know, it's real important to note that at the time, you know, to get back to answering your question, Joe, you know, why 1913 is so important. The reason 1913 is so important is that's when the Federal Reserve System that operates off of credit, that expands and contracts the money supply in this country, which is really paper and credit. 1913 is real important for that reason, as well as the reason that was the first income tax at the federal level when it was imposed, and what brings in a substantial amount of revenue for the federal government today. What you have by means of these systems that were put into place in this country in 1913 is this. You know, Joe, imagine, if you will, an aquarium, and you want to put water into it. And you get a lot of benefits by putting water into this aquarium. You know, in this illustration, the water is really our medium of exchange, our currency. If you don't have an exhaust from the aquarium, and you are constantly putting water into the aquarium, soon it's going to it's going to reach the top and flow out. You know, the aquarium's going to be full, and water will spill out of the aquarium. Well, in order to prevent that, what you have to have is an exhaust from the aquarium that is roughly equal to what you're putting into the aquarium. So if you have water coming into the aquarium roughly equal to the water that is being taken out of this aquarium, then you'll maintain a relatively stable level of water. And so the purpose is, since the Federal Reserve System was going to knowingly expand the money supply, the credit supply, phenomenally, you have to have, once you got that economic system in place, you're going to have an exhaust for all that credit. And, you know, in an economic sense, the purpose of the income tax is to suck excess credit from the economy so that the process of credit creation can occur on a quarterly and an annual basis. So does that explain, how confluence of events in 1913 is viewed from an economic perspective, Joe?
Very much so. So basically, and as I mentioned before or observed from your descriptions, that it's amazing how these bankers have just a well-oiled machine. I mean, they've been doing this for thousands of years, and so they had enough foresight that when they recognized that, hey, you know, we need to create a central bank here, and we're going to call it the Federal Reserve so people think it's actually part of the federal government, but meanwhile, we have to also have this income tax mechanism. It just amazes me at how detailed and how prepared they were, and kind of like when you hear today about how the Patriot Act is thousands of pages long, and yet it just came out of nowhere as if somebody just put it
sitting on the shelf ready for it to be implemented. Right?
Yeah, the easy bake oven, and it comes out in 5 minutes,
yeah.
And it just goes to show you that all of this stuff behind the scenes is been primed and ready, and all they do is take the match and light it. But the American people don't realize that they don't see all the charcoal that's already there waiting to be lit.
At the higher levels, a lot of things are being planned. They're not sitting around twiddling their thumbs.
Well, I think that's an excellent point that we could dovetail into. We wanted to talk a little bit about vaccines and your rights. And as I view it, this is another issue where it's just suspicious to me that the government is putting all these tremendous plans and
Over the last couple of years, you can remember, it seems like, what was it, the former Secretary of State, what was her name during the Clinton administration?
Condoleezza Rice?
No, not Condoleezza Rice, but the fat lady, if I could be so blunt.
Albright.
Yeah. Albright. Yeah.
Albright.
Half-bite is what I call her. I can remember that at the international level, they were making plans for dealing with pandemics across the whole world, and that was being done during the Clinton administration, the late 90s. And, of course, they had been building, I think I remember Madeleine Albright, being involved in some of these scenarios. Well, gee, what are we going to do, if we get a pandemic in this country and, there's a serious economic consequence for that. We may have to close borders and things like that. So they went through all these plans. Well, to me, there's been a system in place, that has been built primarily at the international level over the last decade. And there are plans being made for, dealing with a pandemic. Well, if you build a machinery, it's kind of like that movie Kevin Costner in, build a baseball field and the players will show up. Well, if you build an emergency pandemic healthcare system, you better have an emergency pandemic. And so I think that, my personal conclusion, based upon what I've just seen, heard, and read, my conclusion is that there's been the building over the last decade, probably longer, of a mechanism to deal with pandemics, and now that it's coming into place, now we need a pandemic. The H1N1 flu vaccine, we're told that H1N1 only showed up, this last spring. It broke out of some pig farm down in Mexico and, created a big problem down there, and since then it's spread across the entire world. Well, I ask a simple question. Why was it, and I don't know the specific name of the drug company, I've got it on my hard drive here, I guess I should have looked at
it. Is it Baxter?
There's a patent application here for H1N1, which materialized out of nowhere this last spring of 2009. Why is it that H1N1 has been mentioned in the patent application for one of these big pharma companies, their patent application for one of the vaccines for H1N1? How in the world did, whatever company it is, big pharmaceutical company, know H1N1 would come into existence a couple of years after it submitted a patent application for a vaccine for H1N1? Like, how does that happen, Joe?
I guess they have a crystal ball. I wish they'd share it with us.
Well, that happened, You know, and, you know, my personal conclusion is that, you know, that now that the system has been erected, now that these institutions are in place, you know, now that all of that is built, now we need the crisis. And I think a whole lot of this crisis, whether it's concocted or whether it's real, you know, they're certainly trying to create a scare. And over the last couple of months, we've all suffered from this. You know, you can't, just last night when I'm looking at the 10 o'clock news, you know, they're talking about, you know, the swine flu. We've seen a growing crescendo. The media is talking about H1N1, the swine flu, and it's gathering in steam. And now we're being told that, you know, just this morning as I was driving down here in my office for this radio show, you know, listening to the radio, oh, now we don't have to have two shots, we only need one. One has been found sufficient to protect you against the swine flu. But there is just a whole lot of hype over the swine flu, and there's people out there that are saying, you know, swine flu isn't all that deadly.
Well, Larry, we got a break coming up, but that's like the way, like where this is going. We'll be back after the break to talk more about the swine flu virus. Thank you for joining us.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Overcome. Pass it on. When Marlon Shirley was 5 years old, he was in an accident and lost his foot, but he didn't lose his heart.
When you tackle a challenge that you cannot even fathom tackling, when you accomplish that, the amount of integrity and the will and the heart that you'll get from that experience is what will set you up for your life.
In less time than it took Marlon Shirley to say that, he can now run 100 meters because today he's the world's fastest amputee. Overcome. Pass it on.
America. Born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Join the Cavalcade to Freedom. The Cavalcade back to constitutional government. Climb on board and do your part to proclaiming liberty throughout the land. Join and support Liberty Works Radio Network Fellowship. To view the strategic plan, to spread the word, and to get information on joining, go to www.libertyworksradionetwork.com or call the fellowship office at 410-857-5444. That's 410-857-5444. To join the Cavalcade to Freedom. America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Give you anything you like. You want free college, energy, mortgages, whatever you like. You have come to the right place. I'll tell you why. Who can take your money?
Who can take your money?
With a twinkle in their eye.
A twinkle in their eye.
Take it all away and give it to some other guy. The government.
The government.
The government can.
The sunrise.
Who can tax the
sunrise?
Who can tax the trees?
Who can tax the trees?
Let your own a business and collect up all the fees. The government.
The government.
Oh, the government can.
The government can.
And the government can, 'cause it mix it up, relies on make it all taste good.
Make it all taste good.
The government takes everything we make to pay for all. Healthcare, climate change, pollution. Throw away the Constitution. And who can give a bailout?
Who can give a bailout?
Tell us to behave.
Tell us to behave.
And make the
dishes. Soon we'll have to eat our dishes.
Delicious.
Oh, who can be a failure?
In so many ways.
Instead of getting fired, hey, we'll give ourselves a raise. The government. Sam can, cause he mixes it well as it makes it all taste good. And I feel so good, cause the government says I should.
Now live from coast to coast and around the globe, more real talk, the kind you want, on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Freedom Above Fortune radio show. My name is Joe Bannister, your host. Website is freedomabovefortune.com.
My guest is attorney Larry Beecraft. He's been kind enough to join us for the entire 2 hours. And we were talking about the swine flu and had to cut Larry off there for the break. So, Larry, go ahead and continue.
Well, Joe, you know, here's something that's real important. You know, in this hype that is going on regarding the swine flu, they keep talking about, well, you know, we got to go to the school children first, and then we got to go to the emergency and personnel, and then the people that are involved in the medical industry, and then, you know, so we got to do the military. Well, you know, over the last couple of months, one of the things I've done is I've spent some time looking at all of the state laws regarding vaccinations. Now, if you would like to find out what your own state provides for in the way of vaccinations, if you go over to my website, you know, I've got a link straight off the front page that carries you over to a kind of a long file. I've got it broken down by each state. You know, I've tried to post there, you know, some of the salient features of each state's swine flu or vaccination laws. I've concentrated on Alabama, but, you know, I've done a lot of work on other states. But, you know, there are a lot of states where I've done some work, but I haven't had the time to, you know, pull up, copy the laws, and stick them on the page. But what I have done is I've linked, you know, like let's say the New Jersey. You know, if I don't have anything there about the swine flu, I provide a link. You know, I say here's the chapter of the New Jersey Code and, you know, the applicable regulations. So people, all they have to do is click on those links, and it carries you over there, and you can read it. So I've tried to provide in this file, posted on my website, either the quotes from or links to the appropriate laws of each state that relate to vaccinations. And one of the things that I learned from this, you know, I didn't know this until I actually sat out and did it. You know, most every state requires young school children to be vaccinated. And so the mechanism is already in place for mandatory vaccination of school children. Incidentally, most states have requirements that emergency personnel get swine flu, get the vaccinations. And then also, incidentally, you know, people that are involved in the medical industry, the nurses and, you know, everybody in the hospital, there are laws already on the books regarding vaccinating those folks. So, you know, just from looking at, having conducted a survey of all the vaccination laws in every state and in America, and seeing that pattern, then when I hear the news media about the reports, well, we're going to vaccinate this group and that group and every other group, you know, what do we have? We have the school children. Well, the reason why school children are going to be vaccinated because that legal mechanism is already set up. We're going to have the emergency responders, the people in the ambulances. They're going to be vaccinated. Why is that going to happen? Well, because it's already set up as a matter of law. And then we're going to vaccinate everybody that works at the hospital. Why is that going to happen? Well, that's because the laws are already in place. But one of the things that's real important for me is that, there's really, outside of something like a pandemic, there's really no mechanism for forced vaccinations of the American people. What I have seen in my survey of the laws is that in reference to an outbreak, they can quarantine people. But, insofar as, an actual compulsion that somebody take a shot, again, you need to read the laws in your own state. And, there's this model state act regarding vaccines that's being promoted by, the system. They're wanting the states to adopt that. And if the states adopt that model act, then you'll have a system set up so that when the Centers for Disease Control or the Center for Disease Creation in Atlanta, they come out and say, we got some pandemic floating around. Once a proclamation from the CDC is made, all these mechanisms for, things happening pursuant to state law come about. That's what they want to set up. And I think part of this pandemic scare is to force the state legislatures to pass through this model vaccination law so that they can have this country, in every place, the statutory framework set up so that, we can force vaccinations on everybody. That's where we're headed. I think that one of the reasons why we got the swine flu scare going on right now is to force legislative bodies, the legislatures of the several states, to force them to adopt this model act. And so once every state has a model act in place, which is different from what they've got now, we'll have a system put in place so that, when the CDC comes out with an announcement, whoa, now we're going to have everybody in America vaccinated. And one of the things that I really fear about forced vaccinations is, I've looked into it. I'm a lawyer. I know nothing about medicine, but I can read. And, I've seen some horror stories about these vaccines will do. There are adjuvants in these vaccines like squalene and mercury. And those things kill people. Those adjuvants maim people. We have right now, there's this problem with Gardasil. There's this one big pharma company that's come out and they're promoting Gardasil. And you see the ads on TV. Gardasil, get your, some mom saying, I want to protect my daughter. And so we went down and we got the Gardasil shot. People don't understand, that Gardasil is maiming and killing young girls. And my personal conclusion is I think Gardasil can probably lead to the sterility of a lot of young women. And years down the road, we're going to find out that, Gardasil has had an impact upon the next generation.
Well, it is frightening. So, as you said, neither of us are doctors, but we can read the evidence. And it sure looks to me like these vaccines, I don't know, well, it's hard to determine exactly what their intent is, but based on putting things like squalene or mercury or these terrible ingredients into them, not to mention the side effects and things that happen when you use them, I don't know why they're touted as such a great thing when it seems like, if it's not a direct intention to just harm people, it's an indirect intention that, if we kill a few people, at least we sold a lot of vaccines.
Right. There's a profit motive here. And Big Pharma, and Big Pharma is being paid big bucks by Uncle Sam to produce these vaccines. And so they create the scare, they get Congress to respond, here are billions, make some vaccines. And so there's a financial benefit for the big pharmaceutical companies to come out with all this. And that's the reason why they create these scares. And, when it comes to the profiting from all this, the big pharma companies are there to take advantage of it. And in the process, one of the things that scares me about this is, I'm personally involved in an endeavor. We're not talking about it all publicly over the airwaves right now. But there are things that are going on in the background. And, you know, I've been exposed to some of this information about these vaccines, and there's no safety tests being made for these vaccines. You know, they're coming out with, they've got a, when a pandemic comes about, there's a shortcut process for the FDA, you know, so that you can come out with a vaccine that has never been safety tested. Why is that? You know, just back in 2003, just yesterday, I went over to, there was this lawsuit filed against Rumsfeld in Washington, D.C., and a federal judge in Washington, D.C. in 2005 came out and said, squalene is dangerous. And for that case involved soldiers being vaccinated. And the judge said, hey, look, you can't force, you know, against somebody's will to take this squalene-laced vaccine. It's got to be voluntary. Why? We don't know what's going to be in these vaccines for the flu, the swine flu. But, you know, I do know a federal judge has said squalene is dangerous, and squalene is usually the adjuvant that is used in a lot of these vaccines. And I fear that somebody in government, be it a federal or a state official, is going to come along and say, oh, you've got to take this vaccine. It's going to have squalene in it. And that has never been, that particular vaccine has never been tested for safety. Now, why do we have to go through this? And the probable consequence of that is a lot of people are going to be injured, and some are going to be killed, and certainly a lot of people are going to have their health ruined. Just like back in 1976 when they came along with the swine flu that was, you know, back the swine flu scare that occurred back then, they started vaccinating people and they stopped the program when too many people were dying.
Yeah, was there an incident like in 1976 where that was occurring? They went and this rapid ramping up of vaccinating people with untested vaccines, and a bunch of people died. And I think it was during Gerald Ford's administration.
Yes, absolutely.
And
that happened.
You know, here we go. As far as talking about history, those that don't learn about it are doomed to repeat it. I mean, I wish people would wake up.
Well, you know, in reference to the events that happened in 1976, here they come along, they create a scare, come out with a vaccine, an untested vaccine. And then when they have the program to start vaccinating people, they suddenly find out a whole lot of people are having their health destroyed, and a lot of them are dying. Then Congress comes along and says, oh, well, this is our fault, and they set up this. Well, we'll pay damages now. But, you know, there are people, people have been, that were damaged by that swine flu back then. They're still litigating that stuff today. You know, Congress comes, oh, we'll set up this mechanism so you can prove your claims. You know, now it's going on decades later.
Yeah,
and, you know, people are dying. And, you know, Joe, you know what, let me just say this. We've got an increase in diabetes. You know what some of these adjuvants in these vaccines do? They come along and they force force your immune system to respond, you know, in an extraordinary fashion. And that immune response, I'm firmly convinced, does things like kill your pancreas.
Yeah,
which causes diabetes.
I think that's called autoimmune, that process,
yeah,
where your body basically attacks itself. Well, Larry, I wish we had more time, but we only have like a minute or two left, so I just want you to tell the listeners about your show that's on the Micro Effect Network, what you're going to be talking about, how people can listen to it, and what time it's at.
Well, I've got this is Central Time. It's 2 to 4 this afternoon. There's a little internet radio broadcaster called the Micro Effect. M-I-C-R-O, Effect. It's on the internet. Just do a search engine search for it. You'll come up with the website, and you can listen straight off the internet to the Micro Effect. And Tommy Pryor, who's a friend of mine, a client of mine, you know, he also has a radio program on Liberty Works. You know, I defended him in a criminal tax case a couple years ago. Tommy got acquitted. Now he's got a radio program. But he and I have a radio program on Saturday afternoons, 2 to 4. And today, my guest is going to be a former client of mine, Bill Benson, the guy that did the research project on the checking out the ratification of the 16th Amendment, the Federal Income Tax Amendment. He did that work back in 1984. And he's going to be my guest today on that. Tommy won't be on because Tommy's out running across the country. I got an email from him this morning saying, oh, I got to go to Texas to speak at one of these tea parties. So it'll just be me, Bill, and hopefully Gary Franchi.
Oh.
We'll have a very informative radio program this afternoon. I hope people will listen in.
That's awesome. Well, that's at www.themicroeffect.com. Themicroeffect.com. It's called Liberty's Hammer and Anvil Radio Show. Larry, are you the hammer or the anvil?
We haven't made that decision. You know, some days I'm the hammer and some days I'm the anvil, I guess.
Right, and it's from 2 to 4 Central, and they're going to have Bill Benson on with this historic litigation where Bill's trying to defend the right to actually defend yourself and use the truth in your defense.
Right.
I really hope you'll check that out. And thanks, Larry, very much for being on the show.
Joe, you're always a great host.
Well, I got great guests. You helped me a great deal. So thanks to the listeners for joining me this week. Go to freedomabovefortune.com for more information. And see you next week. Thanks, everyone.
Along with Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry was most instrumental in establishing the American dream. Henry made the following plea. The battle, sir, is not for the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. There is no retreat. But in submission and slavery, our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard upon the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable. And let it come. I repeat, sir, let it come. Oh, gentlemen may cry, peace, peace. But there is none. The war has already begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north shall bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Is life so dear and peace so sweet to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Give me liberty or give me death. Patrick Henry, one of the foremost framers of individual and religious freedom. A son of liberty and the American dream.
The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network.
As long as 60 years ago, when I first started to read newspapers, I read of floods on the Yellow River and the Yangtze. Well, who rushed in with men and money to help? The Americans did, that's who. They have helped control floods on the Nile, the Amazon, the Ganges, and the Niger. Today, the rich bottom land of the Mississippi is underwater, and no foreign land has sent a dollar to help.
The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network.
Looking for a good way to help others who are helping others? Let the Eagle 104 advertise your ministry or service organization. Your gift will support this Faith and Freedom broadcast airtime costs at the same time. Come join this Faith and Freedom Given to Others advertising campaign. Contact me, David Allen Carmichael, toll free, 888-850-1872, or online at faithfreedoms.org.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on Liberty Works Radio Network. Truth in broadcasting.
Shut up is the central rationale behind the leftist program. We've heard it expanded upon recently by Democrat bigwigs who want to bring back some version of the misnamed fairness doctrine to try to knock guys off the air. But even if the left can't turn shut up into law, they've worked hard over the years to make it the custom of the country. It's the essence of politically correct phraseology and university speech codes. Say it our way or shut up. It's inherent in the media's demonization of conservative commentators, the way they try to turn names like Limbaugh and Ann Coulter into bywords for intolerance so they'll just shut up. And why were there more than half a dozen movies attacking the war on terror and not one in support of it? Oh, wait, I know. Shut up. The left here has been making the shut-up argument at least since the 70s, when it became clear that all their other arguments had failed. Since it was the only argument remaining to them, they had to invent different ways to say it. If you pointed out that their weakness allowed the murderous tyranny of communism to expand, for instance, well, you were a McCarthyite. Shut up. If you proved that their leniency toward criminals turned our cities into cesspools, you were a fascist. Shut up. When you pointed out that their welfare policies destroyed black families and created a social disaster of vast proportions, you were a racist, a sexist, uncivil, worse than Hitler. All just different ways of saying, shut up. All around the world, as leftism has failed everywhere, shut-uppery has been called to its defense. The full-blown leftists, the communists, say shut up with prisons and guns. But the Western leftists, laboring under traditions of freedom, are suffering. In Europe, they've had more than of soft socialism the Democrats are now bringing here. Their anti-individualist, anti-religious, anti-patriotic policies have so sapped the energies of the European nations that the continent's once great cultures are now placid and passive, fit for nothing but to be conquered in slow motion by the violent, intolerant Islamist invader within. But when people like Ayn Hirsi Ali, Geert Wilders, or Oriana Fallaci have the temerity to decry the left's empowerment of Islamist hatefulness, they're the ones brought up on charges of being hateful. Not because they're speaking falsely, mind you, but because, shut up. So now, the left is in charge of America. Shut up is on the march. Watch for that fairness talk. Beware of net neutrality. Pay attention to the ways the liberal mainstream news media distort, mock, insult, and exclude the conservative opposition. Listen to the people they don't want you to listen to. Whatever you do, don't shut up. Don't shut up. Don't shut up.
America, born to freedom. The Liberty Revolution is on. Liberty Works Radio.